What's going on, good people? Welcome back to the 1 in 100 podcast. I am your host, Amir, aka the Magic Man, aka the Black Podcaster, and we are back for a special episode. You guys know we do 3 days a week and everything like that, but we got a bonus episode for you guys this week. This is a conversation that I've been looking forward to, and I'm really happy and excited that we were able to connect on this episode. So I have a writer, I have a filmmaker, I have a producer. He's worked on projects such as Titans, Ash versus Evil Dead, and a bunch of other things. He also says on his social media that he sometimes writes comics, but I think he should change that to say sometimes I write comics that are dope as hell. Okay, he's worked on stories for Marvel like Fallen Angels, which was an X-Men story. He did a one-shot Black Panther story. He did an annual for Miles Morales. He did an amazing miniseries for Killmonger that a lot of people that I'm cool with really enjoyed that story. He did some stuff with DC, Wildstorm story with Michael Michael Cray. If you haven't read that, definitely go check that out. Really dope. He did a 6-issue mini within the Detective Comics storyline that went on to be his Batman and the Outsider story. And shout out to Dexter Soy, who's an incredible artist that worked on that story. He did a story which was one of the first ones that I picked up for, you know, the things that he's written. It was called American Carnage. It was for Vertigo, the DC imprint that they have, which is no longer around anymore. He's done stuff for Image, probably one that he doesn't even remember that he did because he works on so much stuff. But I love the story called Boneheads. Okay, that was a 4-issue story. It was fire, man. So anyway, he works on a whole lot of dope stuff, man. I'm happy to have him here on the pod for the first time. So let's welcome Mr. Brian Edward Hill. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm good, man. We out here. How you doing?
I'm doing good, man. Like you said, it's a Sunday afternoon, man. No complaints. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, easy, you know, like a Sunday morning.
Easy like Sunday morning.
There you go.
No, it's a good Sunday. You know, butterflies flying, the sky is out. You know what I mean? Like, we're just chilling in LA, man, making it work.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. So first off, I'd like to just thank you for being on the podcast with me, man. We were trying to connect for a little bit. We finally got you on. Sure. So I was going to have one of my co-hosts on here with me, but one is in Puerto Rico on a vacation. And the other one, he had to work, so I couldn't get them on, but I'm going to hold it down for the crew, man. So I have faith in you. Oh, thank you. I wanted to start here, actually. I had this whole thing about your work ethic and how you're involved in so many different projects at the same time, right, and where that kind of came from. So you could speak to that. But after reading what the WGA, you know, some of their demands and what the reason for their strike, I kind of noticed that you guys that are in that field really have no choice but to work your asses off.
Okay, it's a nuanced thing, right? So, like, yeah. I kind of take the second part first. Mm-hmm. So I'm really lucky. You know, I've been working professionally in Hollywood for about 12 years, and I get paid well to do the things I do, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, I haven't had to worry about making ends meet in a long time. So I'm not in that situation, but there are a lot of writers that are in that situation. You know, people can think like, oh, you work in Hollywood, then you must be just killing it, you know. Right. And a lot of people are, but when you're starting out, you know, it's a little different, right? You're still trying to put it all together. And the business was an easier place to start when I started. Right. You know, and now it's a little more difficult to get your financial feet like up underneath you and all of that. Like, you know, if you're working on like a show for a year and a half or something, and so you're only getting paid like, you know, I don't know, like 70K or something to work on that show. That's not a lot of money in LA. And it's a lot of time, you know. So Yeah, and it's that, and it's some other things. It's the, you know, WGA is looking at the future and trying to make sure that things are going to be equitable going forward and all that. I'm not going to get into the details of the whole thing because I'm not in the negotiating committee. I'm just part of the union. You know, I mean, I did vote for the strike authorization, just to show solidarity with where everything was. But yeah, I mean, there's, you know, there's valid reasons for it for sure. Now, you know, getting to the first part of your question, I'm just interested in a lot of different things. Like, that's basically it, right? So, like, I am a writer in the sense that primarily I write and that generates my revenue.
Right.
But that's not even the only thing I'm interested in doing. You know, I'm interested in visual art. I'm a filmmaker. I just haven't done much filmmaking, you know, kind of in recent years. I like messing around with music. You know, that's a thing that I'm into. I'm also, you know, working on a fragrance. I've been kind of, you know, going back and forth on that, you know, trying to make that work. I haven't put the time into it that I really should have because I've been busy doing other things. But, you know, that's an endeavor that I'm interested in. So the, you know, the kind of polymathic aspect of what I do, I think that's just part of how my mind works, you know, like I'm interested in the things I'm interested in. And for me, the common denominator is the artistic process, not necessarily the form of the art, you know? So like if a comic book seems creatively interesting to me, I'm going to do it. You know, if a TV show is interesting, I'm going to do it. If a movie is, you know, I'm going to do it. If I had a music opportunity, you know, that I thought was cool, I would go ahead and do that. Maybe I combine all of it. You know, I'm interested a little bit in fashion, a lot in fragrances. So, you know, I'm going to move into that space. But it's really just my interest. And it just kind of keeps me exploring myself creatively. I don't get stuck in a rut, you know. You know, and all of the work I do informs the other work I do. It, you know, it just kind of keeps it interesting and evolving in a way that will maintain that excitement I have when I wake up, you know, and say, well, what am I working on today? What am I doing today? You know, but I tell people all the time, like, I'm the dude that might direct a movie and it might do really well. And y'all might not hear from me for a decade. You know, I might just ghost.
Just be out.
You know what I mean? Like, that's also a possibility, right? I'm not, you know, I don't have it all wrapped up into the identity industry, aspects of the industry. You know, I just like working on cool things, and I'm grateful to have the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, man. Yeah. So, so you're talking about music here. Like, do you play instruments or?
I mean, I don't want to overestimate my ability, you know, but I played piano for a while. You know, and I've done a little bit of songwriting, and then from that I started doing a little bit of producing. Just because it was fun to learn, you know. And actually, you know, my friend Nelson Blake, he's a comic book artist. He and I did a project called Romulus. We did Romulus together, and then he did an issue with Michael Cray. And then, you know, we got a couple upcoming things to think about doing. Well, Nelson's also a really brilliant musician. He's a fantastic guitarist. Right now, he's playing in his band Locked in a Vacancy up in New York. And it's kind of metal. It's a metal thing, which is one of his first loves. But Nelson can play like across the board. So we were living together in Queens. It's kind of how we got to know each other. Was living together because I was writing, he was drawing, and I was fascinated with his craft, and I was showing him what I learned about writing. He also writes too, so it wasn't like I was showing him how to write, but I was I think, you know, he was living with a full-time writer primarily, which was a little bit of a different experience for dude. And then, you know, we got to kind of, you know, kind of vibe. And then we would start making some music, you know, and we did some things back in the day, you know. So like, I mean, it's just kind of it's a thing. I mean, I'm not like, you know, Pharrell Williams or something, you know, but, I dabble. I can put something together. I got a couple things on Instagram. You know, if you go to my YouTube, because I have a little YouTube page that I have not put many videos on, the intro song to the YouTube page is one of my joints.
Oh, I love it. I got to check it out now.
A little thing in the beginning. It's like, get in the Ferrari, slide over here and show me things you would do for Versace. So like that, that is me.
Yeah.
Like on some indica,
Yeah.
And probably some Four Loko one day. Just being like, I'm going to be toxic on the mic.
Yeah, yeah.
And just I'm gonna write me a toxic R&B song. And it's so toxic, the whole thing. But like, yeah, I just mess around, man. That's awesome. Mess around and have my fun, you know?
Yeah. So, you know, that kind of just made me think about this topic of discussion that's been going on in the world right now, probably the last couple of months, maybe even before, you know, we all started hearing about it. But the fact that you dabble in different genres with music, writing, producing, and, you know, and comic books and stuff like that. There's been this thing with AI technology, right? Mm-hmm. And how writers and creators and musicians and all this have been kind of competing or, you know, fighting against this to happen. And just based off of what you said, like, there's no way that AI technology can compete with a human when it has these different life experiences. You know, humans have a soul, computers don't. You know what I'm saying? Like, we live in this world where things are happening, crazy things are happening all around us. But do you think that this AI technology thing actually could get legs and start removing creative people from their jobs? Like, do you think that's something that can actually happen or no?
Well, it's a distinct possibility, right? Mm-hmm. I think it would be naive to assume that it wasn't. Look, we are in the burgeoning stages of artificial intelligence and how it's going to affect our kitchen table issues in life, right? We've had elements of this for a while, mm-hmm. but now it's really starting to crest into a thing that will be probably a measure of our lives in small or large part, no matter who right. we are, right? So when it comes to creative work and artificial intelligence, the writing is a little different than the art in terms of the writing, I believe, is more predictive. Mm-hmm. Because the AI kind of analyzes patterns in writing and mm-hmm. then generates based on patterns. Mm-hmm. And I believe the image creation is more of a culling of everything that's out there and kind of a repurposing and regurgitation of that stuff. So it's a little bit different. Now, are we in an era where someone's going to get an AI to write a screenplay? Probably getting close. Will that screenplay be good? Probably better than some people want it to be.
Yeah.
Will that screenplay need some nuance? More than likely, mm-hmm. right? And I think, you know, you don't want to be John Henry trying to prove that you can pound the railroad mm-hmm. more than the machine can. Right. Because in those basic terms, you'll never be able to. But it's not going to mean the negation of human art. Mm-hmm. It's just not. Because while the AI is developing and I kind of sounded like Jordan Peterson there in that knot. Like
well, it's not. It's not. It's not. It's look, it's a bloody important thing, you know. And we need to talk about this. It's not good. It's not good.
Mm-hmm. But. Not that I'm a big Jordan Peterson fan, don't come for me. I've seen some YouTube videos. Settle down, Twitter. So I think we're gonna be looking at art in parallel. Like we always have through time and history, right? Like there's always gonna be the advent of a tool that's gonna make it easier to get to a finished state. And then the first reaction is, oh no, it's going to make the traditionalists irrelevant. We need to kill it with fire, right? Mm-hmm. And then we get some things that are our kind of cool that people are into, and then you develop art in parallel. Yeah. You know? It's like we had similar conversations when the digital audio workstations came out. We had mm-hmm. similar conversations with MIDI technology, right? It was gonna make it, you know, it's gonna invalidate musicians who had the physical dexterity to sit and play the thing. Auto-tune means that we're never gonna have people that can sing. You know, we're just gonna, you know, and is there a measure of that? Sure, mm-hmm. right? Like, can someone who has a washboard stomach and she's got perfect hips and bright eyes and she's really pretty who can't really carry a tune that much, can you get her into the studio and have her sing five notes and let the computer help her out? Yes.
Sure.
Will that make a hit song? You bet. Is it stopping Ed Sheeran from making music? Certainly not.
Right.
So, like, you know what I mean? It's going to exist in parallel.
Just got to find a healthy balance.
Right. I do think the more content you have out there, the more you got to sing for your supper. Meaning, like, maybe there was a time when if you could write a screenplay, you were so unique that you didn't have to work that hard. You know, because you just had this skill that, like, was hard to find, and you put a price point on it, and then, you know, those days might be waning a little bit. You might have to demonstrate why, you know, you're good. But I look at everything in terms of opportunity.
Right.
I'm not just going to sit here and be scared or something.
Right.
You know,
mama ain't raised no punk.
Right. So I'm gonna look at it and say, okay, so this is going on. So what can I do with this?
Yeah.
Right? Does AI make it easier for me to write a book on screenwriting that I don't have the time to write, but I wouldn't mind writing? And maybe I can use AI to help put this book together because it's largely a technical manual and I can add some personality to it in a draft and maybe I get there faster.
Yeah.
Or maybe I've got nuggets of ideas. I don't know what to do with them really. I might have a scene, I might have a thing, I might have a couple pieces of a thing. So maybe I'll feed them into a thing and see what it spits out. Maybe that helps me get closer to something I need to get to.
Gotcha. Right.
You know, so I think you gotta look at this stuff in terms of utility because you're never going to stop technology from advancing. Mm. It's never happened in the history of human civilization.
Facts.
Right? You can't.
Yeah.
You can sit and you can talk to Congress. You can try to pass laws. You can do whatever you want to do. But if you're going to be that person who's going to just put a firewall in front of technological progress, you're going to lose, you know? So instead of that reaction, I think we have to see how we can integrate it, see what we can do, you know? And I understand visual artists that are irritated that, you know, an AI is regurgitating pieces of their art, pieces of their style, generating these quote unquote new images.
Right.
And some of these images are being treated the same way that fully organic art is being treated. I totally get that. And there's some legality things there to consider. You know, there's a classification thing there to consider, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do we have to have a category for AI art that is separate than a different thing? Maybe.
Yeah.
Right. So I think we do need to wrestle with this stuff because people shouldn't be getting their work stolen, you know. But at the same time, I also understand that if you're not really profiting off of stuff, and let's say you're a filmmaker, you're making independent film and you need to get some images together for a pitch deck. This pitch deck itself is not getting sold anywhere, but you just don't have the money to pay somebody to generate original work for your film pitch.
Right.
Now, back in the day, what you would do is you would just go online and you would get work that was already done.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't do anything to it, but you would go to concept art pages and grab that concept art, throw them in the deck. Get some old advertising stuff, grab that, throw it in the deck, right? You're not paying for it, but you're using it in deck and you're not going to sell the work in and of itself. You're selling the project and using the work to show what the feeling of the project is.
Right.
So if someone's able to do that with artificial intelligence, with Midjourney or whatever the stuff is, and they're able to get images that are a little closer to what they're trying to achieve, that are better at demonstrating their vision, I don't have a problem with that, you know, because they're not monetizing the actual images. They're using it as a tool, you know.
Gotcha.
And then some people would have a deep problem with that, you know, you just can't use it at all. Every time you use it, you're empowering it. You know?
Yeah.
And I get that. I get that.
But that's just the world we live in though, right? Like,
you know,
it's not gonna be perfect for
everybody. It's kinda like, you know, I mean, you know, not to step on a landmine, but it's kinda like guns.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, I'm not gonna get into a deep debate on gun control in your podcast, but I will say this. It's never gonna be a situation where you snap your fingers and the guns go away.
That's the truth.
Right? So you can pass laws, we can try to restrict things, and we should, and we gotta be smart about it, but at the same time, you got a black market, like, they're gonna be out here.
Right, they're gonna be there.
And we just have to live in the world that is, to your point, man. Just gotta live in the world that is.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you deep diving on that, man, because it's been out there, man, and it's been kind of like confusing for myself. So I just wanted to kind of get another point of view on the use of that. So before we like get into the comic book side of things, because that's what we do here, we focus on the comic books and stuff like that. But I wanted to know how you got involved in the world of creative arts, period. Not even just comics. Like, you know, what was it that kind of like made you, you were watching something or whatever, and you were just like, yo, that's what I want to do. I want to work on film. I want to work with movies. I want to write. I want to control how that story goes. What made you take this path, and like, how did you go about it?
That's a good question. Origin story, right? Well, I think part of it was, you know, my dad died when I was a kid, and it was cancer. And it made childhood like a difficult in the ways that one would imagine. You know, many, many people had it worse than me. This is not a poor me conversation. But I think I really needed a window into different realities growing up.
Yeah.
You know,
I know.
And movies, stories really took that place for me. And I think also when you're figuring out how to be a man, a lot of times I would be looking at like movie heroes to figure it out, right? Yep. Like, sometimes, you know, is it James Bond? Is it Luke Skywalker? Is it, you know, is it Bruce Wayne? Right. Was a big one. Cause I'm been, you know, I had a dead father, you know, is it Superman? Like, ooh, what is it? Right. Yeah. You know, is it Rambo or Rocky or whatever it is, you know? And so I think that was really what started my love of storytelling. And my mother is a huge fan of movies, and she would always take me to Blockbuster Video. I'm dating myself, but yeah, I used to go to Blockbuster Video and rent video tapes. Used to get the video tapes, you know. And then there were like mom and pop video stores back in the day when they had them. And when it, you know, when you go to like, there's a place called Bijou Movies that was like right around the corner from me. A guy used to work there, two guys, Dave Evanston and Dave Noble, were good friends of mine growing up. They were older kids. They were going to Webster U or whatever, and I was still a high school kid, a little tyke, but you know, we would talk movies. And there was like a common denominator of interest. You know, it's like when you were walking down the street before the geek explosion happened, and you saw someone that had like a Darth Vader t-shirt. You knew people. Like you had something in common with dude.
Yeah, that's my people right there.
You know, you're like, it's my people.
yeah.
That's my people. Maybe you could talk about whether or not Boba Fett could beat Storm Shadow, whatever the conversation is you're going to have, right? But you could get into it. So it was really a love thing. And I've always been interested in human psychology, mainly because I was kind of an introverted kid. So I spent a lot of my time in observation.
Got you.
You know, I watched more than I participated because I never really felt comfortable in my own skin until much later in life. But I think that kind of watching interactions, you know, kind of led me to creating my own worlds on paper and all that. And it just kind of became a thing I was really interested in, but wasn't exclusively what I wanted to do. I wanted to be an FBI agent growing up because I wanted to catch serial killers. I wanted to be something cool, you know.
That makes sense now.
Yeah, I wanted to be cool.
We'll talk about American Carnage later, but that makes
I wanted
sense.
To do like cool guy things, you know. And then my mom was like, can you do something where you don't have a gun? Because if you have a gun, that means there's a reason why you have a gun, and I don't want you in situations where you need a gun.
Right.
And I was like, well, okay. So I went to film school because I was really interested in films.
What school did you go to?
NYU.
Nice. Okay.
And it just, that's kind of took it from there. You know, mainly, I'll be honest, Amir, I knew early on I could not live like people who live out here.
Right.
I wasn't going to be that dude at a cubicle.
Yeah.
Couldn't do it.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't want to be that guy at the office who has a Spider-Man tie and a Captain America bobblehead. And he's more fun than the rest of them, but he's miserable.
Right.
Because what he's doing with his life most of the time is just draining his soul away slowly. Right.
Yeah.
So like the professional arts seemed like a place where I could live life more on my own terms.
Got you.
Which is a big thing that I talk to people about, you know, especially people I care deeply about. Right. You know, it's like, find a way to live life on your own terms.
Yeah. Amen to that. Amen to that. So, okay. So you go, you know, you go to film school, you're at NYU and you're getting ready to start, you know, working on film or TV. Like how'd you kind of like break into the industry? Because I imagine all this was before the comic book stuff, so you know, grind like for the film and TV stuff.
It was a long grind, man. I mean, you know, there's no magic dust to it. I just kept writing things and sending them to people, and you know, you collect a whole lot of no's, and then you get like a little crack in the door. Try to make the best you can out of that opportunity.
Absolutely.
And then you keep go and work at the problem. Yeah. You know? And there was a guy, Christopher Pratt, who was like the first person in the business who believed in me. Mm-hmm. And we worked together for a while. He was my manager for a while. We parted ways because we kind of outgrew each other, but he was really solid. He was there. You know, and it's like everything in life, you don't get there by yourself.
Right.
Yeah. You know, like what you do is you bust your ass to put your best foot forward in whatever endeavor you're trying to do. And if you keep doing that and you're simultaneously confident and humble, you got to have both wings of the airplane, right? Mm-hmm. If you're confident and humble, people will show up that will believe in you enough to give you an opportunity for you to work to the next step. Right.
Yeah.
And maybe they can't take you the whole way, but they can take you some of the way.
Absolutely.
And then you get another opportunity and they can take you the rest of the way. You know, like I have a really good manager right now. His name is Mikhail Mayfield. He's a good friend of mine. You know, he's worked with me for a long time and he's a part of my success. You know, my agents have been a part of that. How did I get them? Because I got them because I had other people that believed in me, introduced me to them.
Right.
You know, and, you know, same thing with like Titans, you know what I mean? Like, I got on that show because I worked on another show. That I got because people believed in me enough to put me in front of Mark Verheiden, the showrunner of Ash vs. Evil Dead. Mm-hmm. And I worked on Ash vs. Evil Dead. I had no idea what the hell I was doing the first week I was on the show. That room was very patient with me. Thank you, everyone.
Yeah.
And eventually I sort of figured it out. And I think I was able to be a pretty good contributor to that season. And then Mark believed in me and then he introduced me to other people, you know, Greg Walker, Jeff Johns, and, you know, and he kind of backed me up when they called him about me. And then Greg became a good friend when I worked on Titans. I was staff writer when I started that show and I ended up that show like supervising producer or something, but going to set, working with actors, working with departments, sitting on post-production, doing all this stuff. Sometimes I'd have to lead the room because, you know, Greg and the other upper level writers, like they were gone. And so I'd have to step in and that's just him believing that I had the ability to do that, man. You know, I understand Greg's still a homie of mine, even though the show is over. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just texting with him yesterday on my birthday. You know what I mean? So,
happy belated.
Thank you. So I'm a firm believer in you just got to keep throwing work at the world.
Yeah.
And when people respond to it, you know, they can sometimes get you where you need to go.
Right.
And, you know, you just keep doing the best you can and hold on to people too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't just go through life burning bridges, throwing grenades behind you every time you go somewhere, because what happens then, and I'm not judging the behavior, but what happens then is you're going to always be starting back from zero.
Right.
Like if you're just going to level up and then be like, peace to that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. But now you're at zero and these people don't know you. They don't love you. They don't care about you.
Right. And you never know when you can use that person again for another step.
You never know what somebody else is doing.
Yeah.
Or somebody else
come
is rising.
Back to you, be like, hey, listen.
You know what I mean? Like you're not the only one out here, you know, trying to make it happen. Everyone's trying to make it happen, right?
Right.
So, you just got to kind of get in that mindset and commit to it. Commit to the hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
You know? And once you commit to the hard can't hurt you.
That's a word right there.
So like that's why I tell people just like don't ask me about easy because there is no easy.
Mm-mm.
Just commit to the hard.
Yeah,
you know, go and be hard, and then find the part of you that can do it.
Yeah. So you mentioned Batman and having a connection with that character. So you know we could jump into some comic book talk. You know, with everybody that works on the show with me here, like JT, he owned a comic book shop back in the day. One of our other co-hosts, you know, he writes comic books every once in a while. Isaac is a manager at a comic book shop.
Okay.
So Batman, was that the gateway to your love of comics, or was it something before Batman that made you want to say, "Oh, let me check out Batman"? Like, how did the love start?
Well, I think the love of Batman started because when my father passed, I just really identify with Bruce Wayne, and so that's where it started.
Yeah,
right. Because he was a superhero that was feeling some of the things I was feeling. I mean, I still have my mom. Bless my mom's heart; she's lovely. So I wasn't an orphan, but he was going through a loss I could understand.
Right.
And he was also a dude.
Yeah.
Now, he was a billionaire dude, so he had that. But, you know, there's that. I think that's the reason why Batman has a special place for people, because ultimately Batman is just a guy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like he has resources and the rest of it, but it's the will You know, it's that I'm not going to quit. Yeah. You know, there's this a quote that a friend of mine, you know, found. I think it was a Batman quote, or maybe he created it and then like put a Batman meme up. Ramon Gavoa. I don't know what Ramon did, but the quote is, "I will find a way, or I will make a way, but I will not make an excuse." And that's Batman.
Yeah.
You know, Batman is find a way.
Yeah.
Right. And I think I needed that growing up, because when you're, you know, in a single parent family, you don't have a lot of resources.
Right.
I was a scholarship kid. I got to go to a nice high school, junior high, Montessori school, because my mom worked her ass off to make sure I had those opportunities.
Right.
But things were never easy. Right. And so I grew up in a make a way.
Yeah.
Frame.
Yeah.
You know, and never felt like I had enough. But I had to make a way. And I think in life practice, Batman had a real meaning for me. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of, if you don't think you can do it, create a part of yourself that can. Right? Like, because Batman doesn't have to go through what Bruce goes through.
Right.
You know, Bruce needs to deal with Bruce. Batman finds a way.
Yeah.
And I started putting a lot of self-esteem in my ability to find a way. You know, and I became that dude in the lives of people, you know, especially like being a teenager, the rest of it. You know, I was kind of difficult and I was miserable and I probably had an attitude problem. But I think everybody knew that when push came to shove, Brian would find a way. So that's really was a personal thing.
Right.
And then, you know, when I read comics and wanted to work in them with the comic book business, just seemed completely on the other side of a wall I couldn't see through. Like, so I tried to, you know, work for Marvel and DC. You know, I committed to the hard, but then just they wouldn't touch me with a 10-foot pole.
Right.
Like, I had people at Marvel say, "You're never going to write Marvel comics."
Wow.
Just blatantly, just like, boom, never going to do it, you know. And you tell me I'm never going to be able to do something, that's
a mistake right there.
Don't do that.
I'm climbing that wall now.
Don't do that. Don't do that to Batman. Don't tell Batman he can't do something.
Right.
Have you learned nothing?
Right.
So I just put it to the side, and then I did Hollywood work, because Hollywood work seemed a little easier, honestly, than comic book work. Because Hollywood just seemed like you just got to keep writing good things and eventually you'll make money.
Right.
And keep yourself alive long enough to write the good things and make money. Right. So I committed myself to that. And then once I got Hollywood dust on my shoulders, suddenly comics liked me a little more.
Yeah, of course.
Imagine that.
Of course. Batman Imagine made that. A way.
You know, you got a crush on the really cute, smart girl in biology class, but she ain't really messing with you. And then she walks past you in the hall and sees a cheerleader laughing at your jokes. And then suddenly she wants to sit next to you at lunch.
Uh-huh.
That's what's going on with you? Goes.
Exactly.
Right? Right? That's kind of how the entertainment business is.
Yeah.
You know?
So what was the first opportunity you were given for comics to write a comic book?
That's Matt Hawkins. That's Matt Hawkins.
Okay.
And to Matt's credit, Matt was never like standoffish because I wasn't like a Hollywood dude. I just hadn't proved myself in comics. And so it just took some time, I think, for him to kind of know that, like, oh, yeah, he's writing and he's doing his thing. But Matt gave me my first full opportunity. Matt gave me a book called Postal that I co-wrote with him for about two arcs and then took over for the third arc.
Yeah.
And that gets you on a shelf every month.
Right.
And you're getting reviews and you're building up a fan base. You know, people are interacting with you. Mm-hmm. And Matt doing that for me, again, talking about, you know, people coming in and helping you out, right? Mm-hmm. Giving me that little bit of a platform. I'm doing interviews. I'm getting reviews on my books. I'm talking to people on social media. I'm building a little bit of a platform.
Yeah.
And that made my Hollywood writing a little sexier, because there's different things that come up when you Google Brian Hill, right?
Right.
So then you do like a Hollywood project. And then that's on there. And then, you know, another comic book thing shows up because it's like another thing. It's kind of like pinball, you know? Yeah. The whole thing about building a successful creative life is just don't let the ball go between the paddles.
There you go.
And you might not be able to keep slapping it up against that one jackpot, right? But just keep it up the table. Just keep it on the table.
Yeah.
All you got to do is keep it on the table. It's like a lot of cats that do really well at pinball, they don't even watch the pinball machine. They just watch the flippers.
Right.
right? And when that, they watch that flipper zone. Yeah. And when that ball comes into the flipper zone, they just slap that ball back up it goes where it goes. You know, sometimes you get the tilt, you know, the jackpot. Sometimes you just get pulled, it goes around, you got to slap it again. But that was really what it was. I just keep, you know, keep the momentum going, keep the ball from going between the paddles.
What's going on, guys? It's your host, Amir, a.k.a. the Magic Man, a.k.a. the Black Podcaster with a 6, not a B. Listen, me and the crew really appreciate you guys tuning in on Monday, Wednesdays, and Saturdays. But we really need you guys to hit that subscribe button and like, share, leave a comment, all that good stuff, man. Let us know that you're tuning in. Let us know if we're doing good, or even let us know if we're doing bad. It all matters to us. But make sure you hit that subscribe button to the 1 in 100 podcast. It's available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Audible. Okay, so hit that subscribe button. We're going to keep on growing, keep on rocking, and we're going to keep it 100. Now let's get back to the show.
Yeah, so let's talk about American Carnage, man. That was actually the first story that I discovered of yours. And, you know, the concept of the story, it was like a story of an FBI agent, which now I get it now because, you know, that was a dream of yours. But basically, mm-hmm. He has a chance to redeem himself to, you know, put a stop to a white supremacy group. Right. And this was on Vertigo Comics. And I believe it was like the last series that they were going to be putting out on Vertigo Comics. It's a 9-issue mini. This was a question that I always had when I first started reading this book. How did you pitch this story? Because I could only imagine it. This is me on the outside looking in, but I'm pretty sure this was probably a room full of white guys, and you're pitching them a story about a dude going undercover to stop a white supremacy group. So how did that happen? Like, where did the idea come from? How'd you pitch it?
I'm not gonna put it on white folks like that because everybody was really cool, right? Yeah. So that was never the issue.
Okay.
Actually.
Okay. Okay.
And I'll be real. So I had worked with Andy Curry on something before. And I knew Andy for a while. It was back when he was editing at DC. And he was a really interesting dude.
Yeah.
And he reached out to me about Vertigo and was like, hey, Brian, we're going to relaunch Vertigo. We're you know, looking at new books, new projects. Do you have something? And I told him, I was like, well, I don't have magical realism on deck. Mm-hmm. Because when I think Vertigo, I think two words, Neil and Gaiman.
There you go.
Right.
Yeah.
And I love Neil's work.
Right.
I mean, I'm such an admirer of Neil Gaiman's imagination, but I don't think in terms of magical realism.
Right.
You know, I've never told a story about an elf, you know, like that kind of thing. I'm just not that dude.
Yeah.
Oh, and he was like, no. Like, there's other, you know, we're just looking at bold storytelling. And I'm like, well, if you guys want like a Brian Azzarello style thing, there's something I've been cooking up. And I didn't know if it was going to be a TV project or whatever it was. I was just like doing some writing or doing some notes. And so I shared with them what eventually became American Carnage. It was kind of untitled skinhead research.
Yeah.
And Andy liked it a lot and was like, hey, you know, this is really cool. What would you like to do with it? And I just told him, well, you know, I'm really in the mood to do an undercover story because that's like a classic story form that I'd like to jump in. And I kind of felt that way growing up because I was a scholarship kid to a school that was very white and very rich.
Yeah.
So I oftentimes felt I was undercover.
Got you.
You know, how do you find the common denominator with people whose experience is so different than yours? You know, and I struggled with it a lot. I wasn't particularly good at it. But I wanted to explore those feelings in a crime drama, basically. And then what I also wanted to do was humanize the antagonists to really explore the emotional motivation behind this stuff, right? And it's so easy to just make someone a cartoon, put a Klan outfit on them, and there you go.
Right.
I didn't want to do that because I talked to people that were in these movements, you know, and some of them would try to trigger me.
Right.
And it's really difficult for people to trigger me. The only people that can really trigger me are people that I care deeply about.
Yeah.
They can trigger me because I care deeply about them. But if it's just a person calling me a slur or something, I mean, you can.
Yep.
You know, it's a slur isn't a spell. It's not like they turn you into one when they say it.
Right.
So, you know, whatever. Right. So once they realize that they could you know, they get N-word and J-word and C-word and whatever they wanted to do. And I was just going to look at them calmly and have them continue. They stopped acting out. Mm-hmm. People stop acting like donkeys if you stop giving them hay.
Thanks.
You know, and so they would, and then they would just sit and talk to me. You know, and they would, I'd ask them about their life experience, if they were a veteran or if this, and growing up this, and have they ever had a friend who wasn't white? Right. You know, and they would talk about, well, yeah. You know, they would say something like, well, of course.
Right.
You know, I'd be like, we all do. It's just, you know, we're talking about the world, man.
Yeah.
Not talking about the world, right? Not talking about you.
Yeah.
Talking about the world.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
And you see this dichotomy operating inside these people. And I was like, okay, you know, I have no desire to just make evil racists because we all know that. That's not interesting.
Right.
And that's not helping us solve anything. Not that my book helped solve anything, but like, I just felt that was the shallower way to approach it. Mm-hmm. And instead I wanted to tell a story where, you know, there was some emotional investment in who these people were, and I felt that you would need a writer of color to do it. Mm-hmm. Because if you were a white writer writing American Carnage, there might be some question of how much of these bad guys lives inside of you.
Right.
Right?
Right.
You know, like, you know, it's like that old saying, only Nixon could go to China. Mm-hmm. Because Nixon was so staunchly anti-communist that when Nixon went to open up China, everyone was like, well, clearly Nixon isn't a communist, so maybe we can see what he's doing.
Right.
Right. So I felt like I, as a writer of color, could approach it in this way without someone thinking that I was a racist.
Right.
Right. Right. And I thought it gave me access to that ability to do it in a fearless way. So yeah, that's really what, but everyone was really supportive of the project the entire time. I never got pushback on subject matter.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't even get pushback on having a Barack Obama mask in it somewhere. Yeah. Right. Yeah. You know, I never got pushback on anything. And to the credit of people, some people were irritated by it. You know, some people felt like it was just part of some woke,
right,
whatever woke is. I don't even know what woke is anymore.
That was around the time when that woke in comics movement was starting.
I mean, every time somebody talks about being woke, I just get sleepy.
Right, like, man,
I don't know what you mean anymore.
Right,
you know, is helping the old lady across the street, is that woke? I think that's woke now.
It might be. It
like
might
anytime be. You being give a polite. Damn about somebody who's not you, you woke. Because you give a damn about somebody.
That's a fact.
I don't even understand.
That is anymore. A fact.
But whatever. You know, do y'all.
Yeah.
And I got some blowback, but I'll be honest, I didn't get a ton. You know, even conservatives who may have found some of my characterization a little too extreme, mm-hmm. or maybe disagreed with how I characterize the nature of some of these points of view.
Yeah.
The vast majority of people respected what I was trying to do.
Yeah.
And they knew that I wasn't just yelling at people, that I was trying to make something, you know?
Yeah.
It taught me that you can't just go into things with this tribal mentality. I never really got like a lot of blowback, no bullying around it. I mean, occasionally somebody would DM me and say something nasty, but you know, nasty people exist. You know, what are you going to do? You know,
especially in the DMs.
In the DMs, man, where they can get away with it. You know what I mean? Like, anonymity, you know, it creates bad behavior. But but DC was support. Jim Lee was really supportive of what I was trying to do, you know? So that wasn't the issue.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously you getting some, you know, traction writing comics and things like that. And then you started dealing with characters that kind of have like some importance in the comic book world of things. You wrote a really amazing Killmonger story that a lot of people enjoyed, and you gave like, you know, more of a background story to that character. You know, you built them up a little bit more. You also did the Batman and the Outsider series mm-hmm. that dealt with a lot of great characters in Batman and Black Lightning, and you even threw Duke in there, which was really cool. I love that part of it.
Yeah,
you throw Black Panther. You did a one shot for that. You did a one shot. By the way, I thought you was gonna be the next writer for Miles. I ain't gonna lie. I thought you was that annual you did for Miles Morales was amazing.
Nelson did that too.
Oh, okay. Yes. I could have put money down that you was gonna be the next one to take up Miles Morales after Solomon and Ackman's run, but Cody Ziegler's killing it, so I'm happy with that. So yeah. You know, when you take on all of these iconic characters and things, did you feel any pressure, you know, doing these stories? You know, how were you accepted, like, you know, in the comic book world when you started taking on these characters?
I mean, I didn't really feel a lot of pressure. Look, I'll be real. When I first came into comics, comic book creators weren't particularly kind to me.
Yeah.
They weren't mean to me. They were just super standoffish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I just wasn't in the club.
Right.
And I don't care. I mean, I grew up never being in the club, you know? Mm-hmm. So, like, it never didn't really bother me. I just kind of kept working. I figured they'll figure me out eventually.
Yeah.
And then they did. And then I met, you know, a whole different group of people that were, like, super welcoming and supportive. Like, Tom King was... Yeah. You know, really supportive of where I was coming from, for instance. Joel Jones.
Oh, okay,
super,
yeah.
Super cool, you know.
Mm-hmm. Catwoman, right?
Yeah. Plenty of other stuff. Yeah. She had Pretty Deadly, I think that's the name of her own book that she did. That was pretty nice. Dope. I received okay. And then I didn't really get stressed out about the characters, really, you know, because, like, you come in to do what you think is interesting, what you hope that people will be interested in. You just can do the best job you can. You see where it falls.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the only real static I got, and I don't even want to bring up old stuff, is when I was working on Batman and the Outsiders.
Yeah, this was one of my questions.
There was a legacy creator who took some umbrage.
Yeah.
With some of the choices I was making, which is understandable.
Right.
Because it's a character that he created. And I totally feel that. And, you know, he had a couple of diss tracks he wanted to put out on your boy. And, you know, but I'm a hip hop kid.
Yeah.
So, like, I'm like, all right, well, you know, you want to try to ether me, you know.
Right.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
But I'm also, I'm not going to clap back at someone who's a pioneer in the business I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like, I'm just not going to do that.
Right.
You know, so
don't
like,
worry, I did.
So if it's is it unfortunate that they may have a negative opinion of the work and of me without really engaging either?
Yeah,
sure. But like, I'm not clapping back at a veteran, man. Like, you know, you got to show your respect and just keep it moving. And, you know, new work does not negate old work.
Facts.
Like, The Last Jedi does not mean The Empire Strikes Back doesn't exist.
Boom.
If you don't like The Last Jedi, then don't watch it.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, like, it wasn't the experience I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't the Luke Skywalker that I wanted.
Right.
But I got my Luke Skywalker. I just watched him at the El Capitan Theater when we had a Return of the Jedi release. Just watch that. You know what I mean? Like, you know, so like, new work doesn't negate old work.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the thing that drives me up a wall. It's not him having an opinion. Everyone's entitled to an opinion.
Right.
But it's not like me doing something in a comic book is negating something he did before.
Right.
You know, somebody comes in after me and does something with it. They're going to do some different things.
Yeah.
You know, like this, this is the business we have chosen.
I mean, and those comments were made, honestly, like, before you even, I don't even know if you were done your first story arc when those comments came out. I want to say maybe only the second issue was out. So, I mean, did he ever get a chance to finish reading your story? You know, because, I mean, Jefferson Pierce was a beast by the end of that story, man. You even gave him a power upgrade, you know? So I feel like you handled the character with care, man.
Yeah. Well, you know, like, I tried, you know what I mean? Except, mm-hmm. Like I thought what I was doing was still thoughtful. And I mean, and look, I had a couple goals.
Yeah.
All right. Like, I felt like Jefferson Pierce needed to be a living and breathing person. And I was more interested in exploring that in real dramatic time.
Yeah.
Right. So there were some incarnations of the character that had happened where his relationship wasn't like the primary first and foremost thing, and the rest of it, he was all closed up to anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, well, I'm going to play with that. I also felt like Katana was underserved as a character in comics in general.
Yeah.
And I'm also like, listen, they're both really hot.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's going to be a thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Between two really hot people that are doing righteous work together, probably. Right?
Most likely.
And I just thought it was interesting to explore because Katana hadn't really been able to, because she was a character that, like, you know, have no emotions because my husband is trapped in the sword.
Sword, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, but that just closes off an entire wing of her soul to storytelling. Right. And I'm like, okay, well, these two characters have their things, and but they may have a thing between, interesting to explore.
Right, right,
you know? And people seem to respond well to it. You know, they DC hasn't done much with that pairing since, and not that I expected them to.
Right,
but I think in general people responded well to it, you know. Yeah. And it
was, I know they did, man. That book was never stayed on the shelf when I was living in Jersey. That
it was messy and it was complicated, but you know, I thought it was
beautiful.
You know,
and the artwork was amazing. Dexter Soy, man. I can't remember who did the colors for it, but that team of artists, wow, they knocked it out of the park, man. And then you got Sanford Green to do a variant cover on the last issue. Just wonderful artwork, man. So hats off to you for putting together a lot of great stories that a lot of fans have enjoyed. But let's fast forward now to what we got going on now, man. There's a preview book on the stands over at the shops right now for the July books that are coming out. And you have a book in there called Blade.
I do.
Issue one, man. So how did you get involved with this?
Well, Will Moss over at Marvel, an editor, he's the homie. And so he reached out to me, and Michelle Marchese, who's also on the book editing, she's great. They were just like, hey, we're going to do a Blade book. Would you be interested? And I was like, yeah, you know, for sure. And we started talking ideas, you know, and I wanted to do something that was kind of big action. I wanted to do something that was real kinetic. I wanted to do something that was a little sexy.
There you go.
You know, and it kind of fit all the boxes I wanted to check creatively, which was what drives me towards or away from anything, really.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it just kind of went on from there, you know. I'm lucky. I'm in a nice place where I don't have to chase comic book stuff. Like occasionally something just shows up in my inbox.
Yeah.
And I kind of respond that way, you know, and I turn a lot of things down, say no a lot, because I just don't think I'm the best person for the job, or maybe it's not the right time for me because I'm just too busy. But yeah, I just felt like, okay, I looked at the previous stuff that I've done before and saw like a lot of merit in it. And I thought I had something new I could offer.
Yeah.
You know, a new way I could approach the character. So, you know, this Blade story is globetrotting. It's kind of like Blade in his own John Wick movie in a way, you know, like it's a big canvas for the character. And I get to create some new characters and put them in his world a little bit to round him out. I think it's a good, fun time. And it has Blade doing the things you want to see Blade doing.
Right.
You know,
but does it it adds some other little wrinkles in there? You know, like we all know Blade is a badass.
Sure. Yeah. You know, I expand on and, you know, I'm only like four issues into it right now. But like, yeah, you know, I think we see different aspects of the character through other characters that he's interacting with.
Yeah.
I think we get the sense that he's kind of a custodian of the second world in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
You have the world of like monsters and demons vampires and the rest of it. Yeah, we have like a new villain that I think is really cool. Nice. I think the first issue is a lot of fun for people paying attention. You'll see the nod to James Cameron in there. There's a whole kind of tech noir Terminator, first 84 Terminator sort of wink in that first issue that I think is really dope. And yeah, you know, it's just a fun time. And Elena Casagrande, she's doing a great job with the art.
Yes, one of the up and coming artists, right, from Marvel, one of the Stormbreakers.
Yeah, I just wanted to do like a fun, punchy book.
Yeah,
you know, that let me have fun on the page and cameo some cool people, you know, and just create an experience that's like a good commuting experience. Buy the book, hit the train, ride the train, read the book. You'll be happier when you get home.
Right. Right. You know? So break this down for me. When you do, you say you get, pitches, you know, sent to you via email or whatever. When they ask you if you want to be a part of like the Blade comic or whatever, how long does it take you to like kind of come up with a script? Like, I mean, I know you didn't have anything just tucked away waiting for somebody to hit you up with Blade. So, you know, is it like a couple of weeks? Like, do they give you like a time frame on how long they need you to come back with some ideas, or do they have the ideas and you just build on it?
Kind of. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's kind of all of the above, you know?
Okay.
It's sort of genuinely collaborative, and then, you know, you kind of bring your stuff and then they bring their stuff and then a song happens.
Gotcha.
You know, like sometimes you're scribbling on the notepad, you know, just like, hands are sweaty, mom's spaghetti, and you know, you're just doing whatever, right? And then like someone else got the beat for you, you know? Right.
Okay. Or,
I've never seen that one clip of Pac. It's my favorite clip of Pac. It's on YouTube somewhere. I don't know how to find it, but he's like in the studio and he's just like running things, right? Mm-hmm. And he's like, okay, so what we gonna do is we gonna put that in there, and then that's gonna be the track, and then you gonna do that part, that spike out part right there, we gonna take that, and that's gonna be the hook, and that's gonna be another song, and then we gonna do that, you know? And it's like, that's kind of how it is, you know?
You
just spitballing and, you know, just kind of comes together.
Building off of each other. Okay.
Control chaos.
Hey, and it usually comes out very well, especially with Marvel. The other question that I had for you as far as like, you know, the Blade thing and maybe some characters that could pop up in there. Recently, there is a story out called The Daughter of Blade, I think it's called, or something like that.
Yes, yes.
And the character's name is Bree. Will she be popping up in this story, or will anybody from the Midnight Suns? Maybe, because I know there's a Midnight Sun story on shelves right now as well.
Eventually, yes.
Okay.
What I wanted to do was first handle him, especially in this first like trade paperbacks worth of issues.
Yeah.
I wanted Blade to kind of drive this story forward without all of that. And there are supporting characters, but they're new, and so they're not bringing all of that. And I felt like to initially jump on his daughter would root the story in that relationship in a way I didn't want to in the beginning.
Gotcha.
You know, mainly, and my other main concern is I want people who are both fans of the character and just want to get more adventures on the page to read it and have fun.
Right.
But I also want people who like are ambiently aware of the character, or maybe they like the Wesley movies and never bought a book.
Right.
To be able to pick up a book without having to swim through deep continuity.
Gotcha.
Because a lot of the problem I think with comics is people go watch a movie and they get hype, or they see a show and they get hype and they want to like keep it going. They go to a comic book store and all you have are things that are so deep in the continuity that they can't get in.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, how many times has a character been in a movie that was super popular and then you go to the comic book store and that character isn't even that superhero anymore?
Right. Or they're like a super side character.
Right. Like the timing is all wrong. Right.
Yeah.
You know, so you're deep into this, deep into that. You know, you love like, you know, you just saw Batman. You want to, you know, read the Batman comics. You go to the store and like Dick Grayson's Batman. You're like, what?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and so I wanted this to be a place that people could just onboard. Like maybe you played the Midnight Suns game or something, or, you know, whatever it is. You just got into the character. Maybe like your older brother or your dad or whatever, you're a kid and they showed you the first Blade movie and be like, check this out. It's kind of raw. Still raw too. That was still raw.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you got hype off of that, you know? So I wanted to have something where people could just jump in on it without having to be experts in the 616 to understand everything that's going on. So I'm not ignoring any of those things. I know there are also readers that are a big fan of, you know, the his relationship with his daughter and the implications of that, the Midnight Suns and the rest of it. So yes, all that, yes. Mm-hmm. But I'm gonna get to it in a way that I think brings everybody together.
Nice. I respect it. The last question on the Blade story, and before we get to a couple of fun questions and let you get out of here, man. I noticed that there's a lot of variant covers, and one of them is Frank Miller. Now, you're a Batman guy. I imagine that you read some of Frank Miller's Batman stuff, you know, Return to Dark Knight, everything like that. How did that happen? Did you reach out to him?
No. No. Yeah, you know, I just called Frank and I was like, yo, Frank, it's your homie Brian. What's going on, man? How you been? Yeah, is the city still sending? Is it still sending? Yeah, man. I'm gonna need you to hold this cover for me though. No, I don't have it like that. That was something that Marvel did. I had no idea was happening. But yeah, Frank Miller was a huge influence on me as a kid. Mm-hmm. Because his work would set off little explosions in my brain.
Yeah.
And it was just visceral in a way that like other comics weren't.
Yeah.
You know? And I guess it's like someone who's like listening to like rap for the first time or something, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. Like you just like put on NWA and you're like, what's this?
Right.
This is speaking to it or heavy metal or whatever it is, or the first person to hear, you know, blues back in like the 50s or something, like it's just getting you in a different way. And like chasing that feeling was a big part of like my creative growth. So yeah, having any tertiary connection to Frank Miller is an honor for me. I mean, I've only met the man one time. Mm-hmm. Years ago, he was just walking through a convention hall in Long Beach. Mm-hmm. And I was like, Mr. Miller. And he was like, hi. And I was like, hey, I wrote this whatever. And he was like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
And I was like, you're Frank Miller. This is an honor to meet you. And he's like, oh, well, that's really nice to say. And that was it.
Yeah.
That was my Frank Miller moment.
Fair enough.
But yeah, I mean, I, you know, there's still like phrases and things that he wrote that stick with me to this day, you know, like there's just aspects of his work that just really, really moved me as a kid, because it taught me how poetry works in comics. Mm. You know, it taught me how to make things evocative with all of the senses.
Yeah.
You know, when he talks about, you know, like he keeps punching him until the sounds go wet.
Wow.
Right? Like you can hear that panel. And I was like, oh, even though it's a book, I can engage all the senses.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, it was a huge honor, but I had nothing to do with it. That's just that's just Marvel being Marvel. Doing Marvel things.
Yeah.
Bless him.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't know. Man. I don't know. I don't know how Jay got on the record, but I'm glad he did.
Hey, hell yeah. Hell yeah.
Sometimes you just get a verse from Jay. You're like, okay, cool. Yeah,
put that in right now.
Let's go ahead and put the remix on. let's release the remix then. I think we're releasing the remix.
Yeah, exactly. Like ain't no ifs, ands, or buts. Yeah, put it out right now.
Yeah.
So just a quick, you know, little fun question here. Are there any characters that you haven't had a chance to work with yet that you know, would like to do maybe an ongoing series? I mean, obviously you've already worked with Batman, but you know, are there any other characters that you've had in the back of your mind since you were a kid?
Not really back in my mind since I was a kid. I think there's a couple characters I could probably do a decent job with. Like, I wouldn't mind doing a Spectre book. I think I could probably do something really cool with the Spectre.
Yeah.
I think Teenie Howard is still doing Catwoman, but I wouldn't mind doing like a Catwoman miniseries. I think I could probably do something kind of cool. I have an idea for that one. It's kind of like a 70s crime thriller, sort of high pressure sort of thing that I think could be really neat. You know, and besides that, I'm just kind of open to whatever if I think I can contribute to it. Mm-hmm. You know, I could probably do something with the Punisher. You know, I think I got some thoughts there. Outside of superheroes, I'd love to do a James Bond graphic novel.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you were ever going to get back to like some of that crime noir stuff that you were doing. You know, when I first discovered you, obviously, like I feel like that was a lane. When I was reading American Carnage, man, I pictured it on a TV screen, right?
Like, well, yeah, I mean, I was writing that when I was deep in the TV, so like I think it was spilling out over into the comic. And you know, Michael Mann is a huge influence on me. William Friedkin is a huge influence on me. A movie called Narc by Joe Carnahan, starring Jason Patrick, who I met, who's lovely and brilliant, and Ray Liotta, rest in peace. Carnahan did that movie. I think Narc was 2002.
Okay.
Which is great. If you haven't seen Narc and you like cop dramas,
Yeah,
mess with it.
Check out.
Mess with it, because it's a cut above for sure. Yeah. And Patrick's performance, I thought, was overlooked at the Academy Awards. I think maybe because it was a cop movie and a different time back then when a movie like that wouldn't get seen the way it would now. or get critical attention the way it would now. I thought him and Leota turned in Oscar caliber performances in the movie, little movie, like $5 million, $6 million movie. But great movie. So that's a big influence. So yeah. And then I love James Bond. I'll always love James Bond. Never gotten the opportunity to do a James Bond, like, you know, miniseries, which I would really like to do. So that's probably, if I could pick anything, it's probably Bond. I think I have a really good Bond story in me. And I think I've had it for at least 4 years or something, you know, because I'm a huge fan of the franchise. And I think there's aspects of the character I can explore that'll be rewarding for people. You know, it'd probably be more of a cross between Timothy Dalton, Daniel Craig, in that vibe more than would be like Roger Moore and Connery.
Right.
Because I think Dalton doesn't get enough credit, because I don't think there would be a Daniel Craig without Timothy Dalton.
Facts.
You know, like, facts. Dalton was doing that work before people were ready for that work. Because he was following Moore. And I love Roger Moore. And Roger Moore is probably the best human being to ever play James Bond. Rest in peace, Roger Moore. Because, you know, the guy was working for UNICEF, you know, after he got done playing Bond. And I've never heard anyone have a bad Roger Moore story, right?
Yeah.
He just seemed like a lovely, lovely, lovely man. And that charm and that charisma and that effervescence really came across in his portrayal of James Bond in a very fun way, you know? And then Dalton comes in after that and wants to bring it back to the Fleming novels.
Yeah.
But most audiences don't read Ian Fleming.
Yeah.
So when Dalton comes in and he's serious and he's a little dangerous and he's not as trustworthy in the same way that Moore was, I just don't think audiences knew what to do with that, really. That intensity.
Yeah.
You know, because there is a dangerous part of Timothy Dalton's James Bond where it's like, this is a guy I want on my side, but he might not be a guy I want in my life. Right? Like, there's a part of Dalton where you're just like, he can he can get to a place I don't have.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and that was a new thing. And between Living Daylights, which is definitely more Bondian in the sense that it has like the international travel and it's got like the beautiful girl in trouble and, you know, the car sequence. It has all the stuff. Between that and License to Kill, which is almost like Bond in like a Joel Silver produced Lethal Weapon movie in a way, you know, it's
because
Bond movies have always taken on the flavor of the time. And so License to Kill comes out in 89 when like Lethal Weapon was a big thing and that the buddy cop movie and the cocaine people. So License to Kill is kind of built in that with like Bond going after like a cartel king or something on a vengeance spree. But there's some just performance stuff that Dalton does in those movies that's remarkable and grounded and feels real, you know. He didn't feel like a superhero. He felt like a real man with core wounds that was still able to do good things, but he might need therapy.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, like he might need to work through some issues. And so, and then you got Brosnan, who I love because Brosnan is Pierce Brosnan. And I tell you what, he might be the nicest person I've ever met in Hollywood.
Yeah, really.
Like Pierce Brosnan just might hands down be the nicest person I've ever met. Like, like he is everything you want Pierce Brosnan to be. Right. Like it is not disappointing.
Right.
You know, that was when I was genuinely starstruck. Because he's just like that. It's you're not meeting an actor, you're meeting James Bond.
Right.
You know, I mean, he is an actor. He probably wouldn't want me to say that because he would probably be like, well, I've played many different characters over my time, Brian. Yes, you have, Pierce.
Yeah.
But meeting you felt like meeting James Bond.
And he played a great Dr. Fate. I just want to say that.
He played a great Dr. Fate. He's brilliant in the Thomas Crown Affair. He's just a really, really solid dude. But his Bond was, you know, a little Roger Moore here, a little Connery there, you know, Brosnan backing it up. But then when Craig came in, the Craig to me was really reading from the Timothy Dalton stuff, you know, making him a flawed, real, damaged, because you got to be a damaged guy to be James Bond.
Yeah.
Healthy people don't do that.
Right.
That's not what healthy people do.
Thanks.
Healthy people make the gadgets and then go home to their cats. You know, like, yeah, you got to be damaged to be James Bond, you know, like there's a part of him that's just broken. Yeah. And I don't think Craig could have explored that in such earnestness in that exploration if Dalton hadn't like first done that work in those two movies, you know. So when I see people just like head over their heels over Craig's performance, which I understand because Daniel Craig is awesome. Never met him. He's like a cool guy. I love his work. But it's like, okay, yeah, respect. But like, remember, there was a pioneer, you know, and sometimes, usually, not even sometimes, usually when you're really pioneering, they ain't gonna get you at first.
Right. Yep.
You know, everybody doesn't remember, right? We don't remember what they were saying about Ye when he dropped 808 and Heartbreaks.
Right.
Right. Like, we don't remember where everybody was like, what is he, what in the world? And this is embarrassing.
That's an amazing album that he did, that he did in 7 days. People don't even realize that.
And it became the grammar of all of hip hop.
Yep.
Now you have to, you know, now you got Lil Baby out there singing through every song. You know what I mean? Like, that wasn't a thing.
No.
You know, you can't just be like, I'm gonna shout a shit upon the man, I'm gonna shout a feel, I'm gonna go and shout him upon the man. Like, what? Like, that wasn't rap, you know? No. So, like, and I mean, look, where Ye is now, we don't talk about that.
Yeah.
We don't talk about all that.
Seen him live 4 times, man.
Yeah, we don't talk about that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like Thanksgiving where it's like, where Ye at? He having some problems right now.
We just gonna send him a plate.
We gonna send him a plate, though. We gonna send Ye a plate, though. But yeah. So, you know, a lot of times the pioneering work, people don't respect it. So in a graphic novel, I kind of want to do a Timothy Dalton movie that never happened, but like could have happened.
Yeah.
So my story's set in like the early 90s, after License to Kill.
Is it Dynamite that owns...
It's Dynamite that owns it. Okay, yeah, it's Dynamite that owns it. It just hasn't lined up. But that's what I have some detail on that one. That's what I would love to do.
Would want to do straight graphic novel for it?
I think so.
Yeah,
I think so. Because I'd want to be able to really sculpt it into a sit down, get a cup of tea, cup of coffee, like big chair experience, you know. But I'm a crazy person. I would probably get a friend of mine who's a really good musician and do our own Bond theme for the graphic novel.
You're not alone. I listen to music when I read comics, man. I need it.
Well, so that way, like if you were a reader, you could scan the QR code and then you can get the download to the Bond theme for that graphic novel. And then maybe I would direct a music video for that Bond song.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I would do a whole thing. So Dynamite, get at me. I got a plan.
Yeah, for sure. I'm here for it. I'm here for it. Comics and music is something that just never should ever separate, ever, you know?
Yeah.
But real quick, man, before I let you go, I did want to ask you this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Back in 2019, I don't know if you remember, it feels like it was 60 years ago now.
Long time ago.
After the pandemic and everything. But Bitterroot, right? Oh. You were apparently going to be the person that penned the script for this movie, right? Or am I wrong?
Well, I was one of the writers who worked on it, right? So the way projects work in Hollywood is, you know, someone acquires a graphic novel they want to turn into a screenplay.
Yeah, I think it was Ryan Coogler.
Yeah. So Ryan Coogler's company, Proximity. Good people. I know them well. They acquired it. I think there was a script that existed and they wanted to do a different direction. And so they reached out to me about it. Regina King, you know, came onto the project. She wanted to do some different things. And so I gave them a pitch of what I would do, sort of based on the script that I read and also based on the book. They responded to that positively. And I did a couple drafts of the project for them. And then my work was done. You know, I was kind of out of contract on that. And I think they hired someone else to come in and maybe they retained some elements of what I did. Maybe they, you know, things change, you know. Like, so there's a fluidity to our business where like a director comes on board and as drafts start coming in, they start seeing things they want to do, new things they want to do, you know? And I think it was a matter of that, is that, you know, Regina was just getting more and more clarification of what she wanted to do artistically and wanted to go in a different direction than what we had kind of laid out and what I was doing. And that, you know, that's just kind of the process. But I was really happy, you know, proud of the stuff I was able to do with it. Mm-hmm. And Regina is amazing. Like, she gave me multiple hour sessions working with her. You know, I would go to her office. Yeah. It would just be me and Regina and two copies of the script.
Building.
And we just went through every page.
Yeah.
You know, and she had such smart notes and all that. And getting that kind of time with a director, especially of her caliber.
Right.
Like, you're just not getting that kind of time.
Yeah.
You know, and I really admire the fact that she gave me that time and appreciated it. And I think it's still moving forward, that thing. I mean, I don't know the details of it, but yeah. So I was one of the writers who came in and did a thing on it. But usually those projects kind of go through hands, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes the reason they'll do that is sometimes a writer is really good at a core thing that a project needs to explore, but doesn't do the other pie pieces, right? Primarily. So it'll be like, you know, so-and-so wrote a draft of Dune because they're really good at bad guys.
Yeah.
And they wrote a draft of Dune that made Baron Harkonnen what he needed to be in the script. But then you needed someone who was going to come in and really build a love story between Paul and his mother.
Got you.
So that's like another writer that comes in. Maybe they can take some of the villain stuff that you did, and that comes over. And then they're focusing on Paul and Lady Jessica, you know, and getting that part of the narrative done. You know, and that's kind of, you know, how it all goes. But yeah, it was fun. And Ryan was really nice. Smart guy. Obviously, Sev Ohanian over there was really great. And Regina and her sister, Raina, they run her company. Yeah, they were really cool. And yeah, and David Walker's a friend of mine. So yeah. Sanford, too. So I was happy to just be a part of it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, hopefully we still, you know, we get that project. But I hadn't heard anything from it. I'm like, well, listen, this guy was a part of it. So let me see if I can sneak this in.
Oh, yeah. I don't know what project status is, but you know, there's no reason I would.
Yeah.
You know, even on things, I mean, I've written things that I think are getting ready to go in some form or another, but they don't tell me.
Right.
You know, like I just kind of hear things ambiently, or an executive friend of mine is like, oh, yeah, so and so, I think they're getting ready to go into production on that script you wrote.
Oh, wow.
And you're like, oh, okay, cool. You know what I mean? Like, because you're like Vincent in Collateral. Like, you show up, you kill five people, and then you get in the plane and you leave.
Yeah.
You know, like your
next thing.
Right. Like, you don't stick around for like the fallout of it. Like, Vincent will never, I mean, even if he survived Collateral, he would never know the outcome of that trial.
Right.
Right. Because he goes back to wherever he goes when he's done, you know, offing five people out of that briefcase. Right. So it's kind of like being a writer in Hollywood. You know, you just got to kill your five people and, you know, Bong Shui, I Ching, whatever happens, we got to roll with it.
Yeah. Well, listen, man, I really appreciate you coming in and dropping some gems on us, you know, not even just as far as, you know, creating and things like that, but just life, you know, and just, you know, working hard and continuing to keep your eye on the prize and not burning bridges and just, you know, being kind to people and everything, man. All the things that you dropped for us today, I know a lot of people are going to appreciate what you had to say today. So with that said, just let people know where they can find you on Instagram, or social media, is all that good stuff. Oh,
yeah, and I'm not super active on social media, but you can find me on Twitter at Brian Edward Hill. That's my name, Brian with a Y, at Brian Edward Hill. You can also look up Illuminati. That would be my Twitter thing, you know, because we got the one eye. We got to keep the one eye open.
Always.
Got to keep the one eye open.
Oh.
And I'm on Instagram. That is Brian E. Hill, Brian with a Y. I'm there. Twitter's probably the best way to holler at me, even though Twitter is a hot mess right now. It's still probably the best way to reach out to me.
Yeah.
And I used to have the blue check mark, but like, then they wanted me to pay for it. We ain't, you know, we men now, ain't we?
We're not doing all that.
No, I'm not. Mm-mm. Sorry, Elon. It ain't that serious, dog. It's
definitely not.
It ain't that serious. but you can find me on there and just holler at me and whatever. And, you know, if you're listening to this, you're watching this, want you to have a good, you know, safe day, and appreciate you, you know, giving me and Amir your time.
For sure.
And, you know, go get it.
Yes sir, and go get some of those books, man. You might not be able to find a lot of them in floppy form, but there are trades out there on Killmonger, American Carnage, Batman Outsiders, which is one of, it's just an amazing Batman story. Yeah, go check it out, man. So go find all those books, man, and go let Brian know that you love the stories and all that good stuff. And we will definitely catch you guys later this week, man. Hit that subscribe button and do all the good things that you guys do for the podcast. And we'll holler at you next time, man. Peace.